marching at the dawn of the day. All the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses.
Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses.
Welcome to Bread and Roses, feminist news and public affairs on the KBOO airwaves since 1978, the longest-running feminist radio broadcast program in the country.
Bread and Roses is a collective of women and non-binary radio activists who give voice to those in global and local spaces working for social justice and equity, and we strive to challenge systems of oppression. All this, and we have fun. We want our bread and roses, too. Get it? This is Mason Meany, and I'm here with my co-host for the night for Bread and Roses,
Celeste Gurevich.
And I'm Pamela Santos. Tonight, we're bringing you three stories. First up, we're going to have Danica Brown talk to us about her 3 weeks' time at Standing Rock. Then we're going to hear from Adrian Cabouet, board chair of In Other Words, and also a new segment. It's called Doing Things. And our guest was Stephanie L. Ghostin, just talking about an event series called The Lab. So right now, we're already in the first week of October. The Standing Rock direct action has been going on for months. Bread and Roses invited someone who'd already been to Standing Rock to really talk about her experiences there.
My name's Danica Brown, and I'm a member of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. I'm White Crane Clan, and I'm Scottish of the Ross Clan, and I'm currently a doctoral student at Portland State University in the School of Social Work, conducting research with my tribe on how historical trauma impacts our community and the healing and transformation of that trauma, specifically around the Trail of Tears. I was asked to come out to Standing Rock with some sisters to support them in solidarity of the work that's going on there currently. For those who don't know, there's the Balkan Tar Sands Project, which is a tar sands project that's creating this really poor quality crude oil, needs to be transported across the seas. So they've been transporting it by train, and that has not been worked out very well for them, as the train wreck that happened in the gorge a few months ago was an indication. So they're building these pipelines to pump the crude oil across the country to take to other countries primarily. And so in this particular pipeline, the Dakota Access pipeline is, or commonly referred to as DAPL, is a project that's taking crude oil from the Balkans, which is in Canada and North Dakota, across the country towards the east. It's going primarily across South Dakota. And the original plan was to put the pipeline, essentially, I think, north of Bismarck, North Dakota. And a number of people in the city of Bismarck, North Dakota, were very upset about the prospect of a oil pipeline going through their homes. So the state or the project decided to move the project south to just outside of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. The pipeline doesn't cross the reservation itself, but it is within their ancestral territory and on sacred burial grounds and sacred land sites is the proposed project. The scariest part of this project is that they're proposing to put it underneath the Missouri River. The Missouri River, which is one of the longest rivers on this continent, is also the water supply for about 18 million people, including indigenous people and non-indigenous people. So The thought of putting a pipeline under this country's largest water source is really terrifying to a lot of people. And so there was a woman, her name is LaDonna Allard. She's Standing Rock Sioux. She inherited a piece of property just outside her reservation that is on the Missouri River. And her son is buried on this property. And the thought of them putting a pipeline underneath this river and the pretty significant likelihood that there'll be a leak was really heartbreaking for her. So on April 1st this year, she started the sacred stone camp on her property and essentially started what some people would refer to as a protest or direct action, where she was called a number of people to come out and occupy the land and do essentially a protest. When I went out there, what became really clear is that this isn't a protest. It's a direct action, nonviolent direct action, but it's centered on ceremony. And it's very different than any other experience that I had. And so I'd like to share a little bit about that. And so this is just my experience. I think I was at Standing Rock. I was at this at the Red Warrior Camp, which has been called a number of different things. Red Warrior Camp, the North Camp, the Protectors Camp. It's been called lots of things. It's the largest of three or four camps out there now. When I was there, there was anywhere between 2,000 and 5,000 people at any given time. And I was there for 3 weeks in September. And so I was actually asked to go out to Standing Rock to help develop a woman's camp. One of the things that we learned when we went out there, and that's very, very clear, is that this is a woman-centered, women's-driven movement. It's the women and elders who are making decisions about this action and how things are going to go. And it's the women, in my experience, who have been pushing this action and encouraging people to come out. And then within that, also organizing actions, but also supporting all of the people who are coming out to Standing Rock. So not only are they doing a lot of the direct action work and being on the front lines, they're also doing a lot of the emotional labor in the background, the cooking, the cleaning, the feeding, the helping, the, you know, taking care of children and taking care of elders. So they're doing a lot of that work. They really felt the need that there be a space for women to be able to go and feel safe and process, and that was kind of centered on traditional values and beliefs around women. Because one of the things that was also pretty clear there is that there's a lot of internalized colonization that's kind of playing itself out, and I won't go into the details about that, but that a lot of that internalized colonization in my experience was centered around gender and gender roles there. So there's, and a lot of it was also generational. So there's kind of this older group of people who have a very specific idea about what they consider to be traditional gender roles. And then there's this kind of younger group of people coming in who have a more kind of critical analysis around gender and roles. And what that means is, like, there were a lot of Two-Spirit people there, or people who did not identify within a binary context. They identified as non-binary, and it seemed like a lot of folks didn't know how to deal with that. So we were, you know, kind of tasked to develop a space where people could, women in particular, could come and have a place to process. So when I got the call, I had really been being felt like really called to go. And I didn't know how I was going to get there, and I didn't have the resources I thought to get there. And then I was kind of like waving back and forth, like it's a, you know, essentially a 3-day drive and then a 3-day drive back. And, you know, who was I going to touch base with there? All these kinds of questions, you know, was it safe for me to go out? You know, but I really felt a call to go. I really felt like my heart was being called to go out there. And then my sister in Seattle posted on Facebook that she was going to go out there and do this Wionin camp, this women's camp, and they were doing a call out for supplies and resources for that. And I just called her and said, can I come with you? And she said, yep. And 2 days later, I was in Seattle filling up a truck and a car full of supplies that we got donated in 2 days, and we were driving out. And I had no idea how long I was going to be out there. I had no idea what to expect. I had no idea what was going to happen. We just kind of went out there. And as soon as we got there, when you drive up onto the Red Warrior Camp, it's right on the Cannonball River. And there's just like all these teepees and fires, and then you drive down into the main entrance, and there's this like two sides of the road are just covered with flags from tribes and nations that are offering solidarity and support. And when we got there, there was maybe 100 flags, and when I left, there was probably over 200 flags of both tribal nations and other indigenous communities all over the world were offering support and solidarity reflected in these flags. And so you drive in and you kind of check in, and they ask you who you are and where you're going, and if you're camping, and we let them know, and they kind of said, yeah, you can go camp wherever. And you know, we went, and we wanted to be in the most center part of the camp as we could, and we found a spot and put up a flag, made a flag, and set up camp. And we had gotten donations of a lot of reproductive health supplies, and we had all kinds of tents and extra tents and extra sleeping bags and rolls and everything like that. And we just started setting them up, and then within an hour, we had women coming to our camp asking if they could come hang out with us and if they could have a place to stay. And then within the maybe a week, we had 8 women camping with us, or 10 women camping with us, and we had like 8 children there at one point, and 2 dogs and a horse. And so, and a lot of relationships were built very quickly. You know, these are relationships that, even though I was only there for a short period of time, that I feel like I'll hold forever. We had a lot of conversations about misogyny and patriarchy, and like what there was these teenage girls who would come into camp, and they'd be like, "What's the difference between masculinity and misogyny?" And we'd be like, "Sit down, girls. It's going to be a while." But they were like, you know, interested in having these conversations. And we had a lot of zines and things like that that we offered. And we just make coffee and tea and sit around and talk and share. And then every weekend we'd go around the camp and pass out condoms and let them know that we were there and where we were. And so that was kind of the calling and why I went. And then while I was there, I soon experienced a lot of different ways to engage in direct action that were really, really some of the most beautiful, transformative, movement-building experience of my life, even just in the 3 weeks that I was there. I was part of the action where that was documented by Democracy Now!, which is where they brought in these dogs. And what was really interesting about that was not the fact that this private security team had these really ill-prepared dog handlers and dogs that did not seem to be trained properly because they were like biting their own handlers and, you know. But what was interesting was, and if you look on the video, on the Democracy Now! Video, what I see in that video is 500 years of internalized trauma awakened and transformed. Because Columbus used to use dogs on indigenous people, right? So we have this ancestral memory that was triggered in that moment. And those private security firm, I think, thought they were going to pull out those dogs and we were going to turn around and run or stop or something. And like I said, what I saw there was 500 years of kind of ancestral memory that was triggered. And we didn't turn around and run. We pushed them back like 3 miles. They had weapons, they had dogs, they had pepper spray, they had vehicles. All we had was our voices. And we just kept moving them forward. And for me, to be there and then kind of being engaged in that and seeing that was like so powerful. And, you know, and then seeing the video now kind of like in hindsight is also just kind of like powerful, not in the fact that it's like triggering for me, because it's not, because what I saw there was transformative healing in the form of direct action. And these are the things that are different about this movement that I've never experienced before in other movements. You know, there were other times where another action that we went through, there was a rally in Bismarck. And so the rally came right after the announcement that President Obama had, he set a perimeter around the river, 20-mile perimeter. It was a no-work order, 20 miles around either side of the river. This was after a judge in North Dakota ruled in favor of the Dakota Access Pipeline. So the feeling of this rally was really jubilous. Everyone was really happy. I wasn't sure what any of that meant for anything or what it had to do with the long-term kind of sustainability of this program, but whatever happened that day kind of shifted the way that people were feeling in the camp. And so people were really happy, and there was this rally, and it was initiated by youth. So they wanted to have this rally, and so we went to support them. And then at the end of it, there's a number of women, primarily from the Pacific Northwest, who came, and we all had banners. There was 20 or 30 of us, and we all had banners, and we kind of lined up. And we were chanting and singing, and but there were probably 60 police officers in riot gear in 2 rows. At the end of the rally, we turned around, and we faced the police officers, and we sang a respect song to them, and then we sang the Strong Woman song to them. And then a number of the women who were part of this group turned around and talked to the police officers about what it means to respect our Mother Earth and what it means to respect women and what it means to engage in this way. And that the purpose of these actions is to not just support Standing Rock, the people of Standing Rock, but to support humanity. And here was this moment where these women, just women, turn around and confronted armed police officers in riot gear and sang them a song of respect. That was really transformative as well. And those police officers had no idea what to do. They were so uncomfortable. They were like kind of moving around and dancing, you know, not dancing like, but, you know, they didn't know what to do. They were so uncomfortable. And, you know, and then we turned around, we left, and we went back to camp.
There's gotta be some hope. There's gotta be some hope. There's gotta be some way for you to send your dogs away and to leave the land alone.
This is also a youth-led movement. It was, you know, a number of Standing Rock youth that ran from Standing Rock to Washington, D.C. To gain awareness about what was going on at Standing Rock. There's a youth council at Standing Rock that advise the greater council on what they would like to see done and how they would like to see it done. So there's kind of two sides to it. There's this woman-led side, then there's also this youth-led side. And so although, you know, there's still elders and there's still men who are kind of taking leadership roles, it's still guided by women and by youth. I mean, we're already seeing these actions impact the way we view land, you know, environmental rights movements, right? It's already shifting the way that we're seeing it. There's 5,000 people out there right now living in teepees and living in tents from all over the world. You know, at this point, I understand there's like over 300 tribes represented, and there's like 19 tribal communities from around the world who came to offer support. The Sami people from Norway came. You know, the indigenous people from Norway came to offer their support and solidarity for the work. We've never seen that before in the history of not just the United States. We've never seen this kind of solidarity happen ever on the planet. And I think that's because of the work that women and youth are doing to set up relationships and using social media. Because there's a media blackout on this. You know, you can't find information about Standing Rock on the normal popular news outlets, you know. And so they've been really, really smart in developing a lot of propaganda using video and images and social media to get that information out. And our youth who are developing art and creating posters and developing videos and writing songs and doing all these really creative, innovative ways to get the message out there. So not only is it a movement driven by love and compassion for the people, it's also a movement that's creative and cutting edge in a way that's still centered on traditional values of community and relationship to land and water and looking at all of these things in relation to our mother, our earth, and paying homage to that. So there's this is also a movement that we haven't seen develop in this kind of way. So I think that in years to come, we're going to be looking at whatever the fallout is. I think years and years to come, we're going to be looking at what happened at Standing Rock and kind of figuring out what happened and how things happen and why, and being able to look at it. There's just really amazing work that's happening. You know, the camp itself, there's 5,000 people there. And when I was there, there's conflicts, but they're always resolved peacefully. 5,000 people who are sharing food, who are sharing resources, who are sharing medical supplies, who are, you know, sharing all of these things. You know, the camp has their own rules, kind of expectations for behavior, but each within the broad camp, there's lots of camps, individual camps, like autonomous camps, and they have their own ways of dealing with things, and they have their own, so there's like these autonomous camps within the broader camp. So there's a lot of mutual aid happening. There's a lot of autonomy happening. There's a lot of still community building and sharing that's happening. So even just the camp itself is just like this amazing experience. You drive into the camp, and like I said, there's like 200 flags. And then, you know, there's 7 kitchens that are feeding all of these people. You don't have to bring food. You know, they're providing food. And there's some tribes that are hosting, camp kitchens. So when I was there, there was 7 kitchens that were providing food to people. When I was there, there were 4 medical tents. One of them was all medicinal herbs and traditional medicine. So there's everything that you need is there. And people are providing and sharing with each other. And it's really, really beautiful. And that's not to say that there's not conflict. And that's not to say that resources are sometimes not allocated evenly throughout the camp, but I think they're working on it. And it's an experience within that context that I wasn't prepared for, to see that kind of communal living happening. I felt really, really safe when I was in camp. When I would leave camp, I didn't feel safe. But when I was in the camp, I felt safe.
We're fighting for our right to keep the future bright and protect the ones we love.
I mean, I think that this is a pinnacle moment in not just American history. I think that this is a pinnacle moment in humanity. I think that in 50 or 100 years, people are going to look back at this moment at Standing Rock. Whatever the outcome is, they're going to look at this, and there's going to be some knowledge that's gained or shared in the way that we engage in civil disobedience, in nonviolent direct action. I think that people are going to look back and know that the Standing Rock people were not just standing up for their land or their water or their people, that they were standing up for humanity, and that they are putting their lives and freedom on the line for the betterment of all humanity, of the planet. And I think that that's a significant shift in the way that we engage in direct action, in the way that we are confronting colonialism, essentially. And I think that it's going to have the impact that it has because of the involvement of women and children in this movement.
Drinking water. This is for our sons and daughters. Our sisters and our brothers. We are camping out for each other. We are stronger when we band together, and we're standing up for the water. Don't poison the future.
So if you're tuning in, this is Bread and Roses on KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Pamela Santos. We were just listening to Danica Brown. We've been featuring music by Ray Zaragoza, In the River, a protest song for Standing Rock, Chris Dirksen from the album Orchestral Powwow, New Women's Song. So up next, we wanted to bring a little bit of visibility to, in other words, the feminist community space here in Portland, some recent developments, and just have people speak for themselves. I'm talking to Adrian Cabouet. Adrian, you're here on Bread and Roses just to be able to give us some background on some recent developments with In Other Words.
Hi, so yeah, I am the current board chair of In Other Words. I've been on the board for about 2 years. We were recently in the news because we put up a statement formally suffering our relationship with Portlandia, the television show, because we thought it was ultimately harmful to our community and to our organization, and it went against our politics. And folks respond to that really strongly, and that's why we're on the radio today. In Portland, I would definitely say, I mean, there are feminist organizations, but we represent a very different kind of feminism for the city of Portland. Like, we are predominantly a POC organization. Our board is mostly people of color. That is very rare. Our feminism deals specifically with the issues that address working class women and femmes of color. Like, we are talking about poor brown and black women. We are not talking about middle class cis white women.
And definitely in terms of, I would say, people's image of In Other Words is very different from what you're telling us about the community space.
Yeah, and that's probably due because it's a recent change. Like I said, I joined 2 years ago, and before that, there had been very few women of color on the board at all. When I joined, I was the only person of color at all. I'm actually the only African board member the organization has ever had. And so when I came, it was a very, very white place, and it was mostly middle-class ladies, and that was kind of the demographic that was served. And over the past 2 years, as we've gotten more intentional about opening up the space to folks who need the feminist movement, it's become browner and browner and more working class, and that's been intentional.
Every one of the media articles, and most of them that are outside of Portland, but even some here in Portland, still refer to, In Other Words, as the feminist bookstore.
Yeah, the change to the community center actually happened before I got there, but folks kind of still associate us with the feminist bookstore. We do still have a bookstore in the space, but we are mostly a community center now. We work with groups, social justice groups around Portland, provide them a cheap or free space to organize, like Black Lives Matter Portland, like the All African People's Revolutionary Party, like PFLAG Portland Black Chapter, which is now the Sankofa Collective Northwest. Like, we try, like, there are very, very, very few spaces people can just hang out or just organize in Portland that are not going to be expensive or are going to be unsafe. And so we want to provide a place where people could come and feel comfortable and be able to build the capacity and build movements.
I would say it was really important that people had started to get to know about it as an organizing space, especially with its placement in the neighborhood is so important, of being like in a historically African-American neighborhood that has been gentrified.
Right, yeah, we definitely owe the community a debt, right? Because we moved from Southeast Hawthorne to Northeast Killingsworth, displacing the residents of Northeast Killingsworth, and that's an ongoing process for a very, very long time. When you walk down Killingsworth heading towards In Other Words, it would be all black-owned businesses until you got to In Other Words, and then it would be all white hipsters. And it was like a very clear line of demarcation, like a very clear border, and that wasn't cool. Like, we are very intentional about contributing to the community that we are sitting in, that we, in which we displace people. We want them to be welcome in our space and like have a say in what the space is. And so that is the focus of a lot of our work, and I think that we've done a pretty good job.
And what are you hoping to accomplish with the crowdfunder?
Over the past 2 years, we have made drastic changes in like the politics and just like the culture of the space, that we've been very successful like that. We created a space that is explicitly revolutionary, that is not just serving upper middle class liberal white folks, but is serving poor and working class African and brown folks. And so now we want to not just survive, we want to thrive, and we want to provide programming for those communities. We want to provide social service programs for the folks in the neighborhood. We want to be a safe space that people can go to if they need to escape state violence. And we also want to provide political education programming. All that, unfortunately, takes money and capacity. And so the purpose of this fundraiser is to give us a space to do that.
Be weary of the ways of the world. I'm weary of the ways of the world.
Is In Other Words also pretty much opening that space in a way, like, for families as well, when we really consider, you know, community spaces to be a certain way for when... Yeah, when we consider the feminism to be intersectional, does make that space, you know, child-friendly?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Like, that is a critical part of the organizing work that happens. And in other words, like, it is very, very rare for there to be a meeting or an event in our space that does not have childcare. Because, first of all, like, most of the folks that are doing this work are women and femmes, and a lot of them are poor, and a lot of them have kids, and they cannot afford childcare. So in order for them to have the capacity to organize in our space, we have to provide childcare. We have to, otherwise they can't come. And like, we're just excluding like the people that are doing most of the work. It doesn't make any sense. So yeah, yes, children are welcome, and we are very intentional about that.
Is there anything else that you want to let Bread and Roses listeners know about it? Could you tell folks what the website is, just in case it helps? I mean, which crowdfunder site are you using?
So we are using Generosity by Indiegogo. We actually have like a shortened link that's easy to remember, which is bit.ly/donate2IOW, with IOW in all caps. And then our website, where you can find the link as well, is anotherwords.org, and it's been recently redesigned. We're also starting a blog series that's going to feature women and femmes of color talking about their perspectives on the feminist movement and like providing voices that we don't typically hear in feminist writing, highlighting them in our blog for basically the rest of the year, because we want people to hear voices that are typically silenced in political discussions.
Those blog posts, because it's still work, I heard it's going to be paid.
Yeah, we don't make women or femmes work for free, especially if they're women and femmes of color. So yeah, we are paying $100 per blog post, and we are still accepting submissions. So if folks are interested in writing for us and they are a woman or a femme of color or a queer trans person of color, please email us at board@anotherwords.org. The pay is $100 per post, and we are extremely flexible about content. Like I said, we want to hear voices that are typically silenced in feminist discourse and in political discussions.
One more time. People can go on to pretty much anything to do with, in other words, any way that people can help. Could you give the website and anything else that people should know to get information?
Yep. So go to our website, which again is anotherwords.org, and click the donate button. There's like 15 places on the site where it's at. If you click donate, you'll be taken to our Indiegogo, and you can donate to our crowd fundraiser there. We're also constantly in need of volunteers. And if you're interested in volunteering, either for a project or a regular shift, you can send us an email at volunteer@anotherwords.org, or just come into the store and talk to someone who's on shift right there. And then also, if you want to write for our blog, and we are still accepting submissions, and you are a woman or a queer or trans person of color, please send us an email at board@anotherwords.org with a pitch, and we will respond to you right away.
Thank you so much, Adrian.
Thank you.
I tried to drink it away. Tried to put one in the air. I tried to dance it away. I tried to change it with my hair. I ran my credit card below. Thought a new dress would make it better. I tried to work it away. But that just made me even sadder. I tried to keep myself busy. I ran around in circles, think I made myself dizzy. I slept it away, I sexed it away, I read it away, away.
Sometimes
wanna fill those metal lines. Yeah, it's like cranes in the sky. Sometimes I don't wanna fill those metal lines. Yeah, it's like cranes.
You were just listening to Adrian Cabouet from In Other Words, and this is Bread and Roses on KBOO.
You can connect with us on the KBOO website, kboo.fm/breadandroses. There you can access our podcasts and share feedback or show ideas. Like us on Facebook, KBOO Bread and Roses, and we are on Twitter, @BreadRosesRadio.
We always welcome new collective members, and if you're interested in joining us as a producer, host, or engineer, no experience necessary, please contact KBOO's volunteer coordinator, volunteer@kboo.org.
Last up, and I thought it was pretty important for us to make sure that we have some time for it, we wanted to get to where people could really talk about projects that they're interested in. The big and small things. And so here you go.
This is our segment, Doing Things.
Anyone but men.
This is Pamela from Bread and Roses. I am speaking with Stephanie L. Ghostin. What are you going to tell us today?
Today, I'm talking about The Lab. It is a space for Black kinship, community, and love in the Portland area.
So some of the events that you have coming up, tell us more about it.
Sure. We have two kinds of events. The first kind are actually hosted by The Lab, and we're trying to support Black businesses and vendors in the process. And then the second kind of events we have are called The Signal, which is a signal for Black folks to come convene at a certain place that we're not necessarily hosting. So we have one Thursday, I believe it's tomorrow is the 6th. Thursday, October 6th is going to be at Fortune. We have a Signal event there. We're supporting Quaz, a DJ who DJs there. Next Saturday, which is October 15th, we're supporting a Signal event at the Blackout, which is at Gresham Skate Park. We're supporting the Northwest Skaters group. And then our next The Lab event is going to be October 22nd at Abbey Creek Winery in North Plains. So we're going to have like a dinner and an evening of talking and conversations and stuff like that. So it'll be super fun. We're jam-packing October. And there's one more event at the end of October. We're doing a Signal event at, there's a series of plays called Every 28 Hours Plays. And every 28 hours, a Black person is killed at the hands of law enforcement or a vigilante. And it's a play, it's a series of plays based on that. We'll be at that event as well.
What made you decide to start this?
So my partner and I moved from Washington, D.C. in May, and we're really used to like hanging out. We're used to having folks over, having just good company. And we were really looking for that in Portland. And folks were like, yeah, we get together sometimes. You're across the river and I live in Hillsboro. So we're like, we need to bring all these folks together. Let's just hang out. So the number one impetus was just community. We wanted to spread love, spread community. Then we were going to these different events, and we were hearing all these like conclusions that people had. We went to one event and we heard black women say, well, black men this, black men that, black, I don't see any black guys. Do black women date black men date black women? And then we go to other events and the guys were saying the opposite. We're like, we need a space for these people to come together, talk to each other, talk about these assumptions that they have. And for us, the best, it's not for singles only, it's also for couples. It's really for all the black community. But we had trouble finding couple friends. Like, I barely like, you know, one person in the relationship. Like, we both have to like both people. It's really, really tough. So we said, well, let's just create this space for folks to come together, talk to each other, convene, challenge each other, and start some of those healing processes that we really, really need to create a unified community.
I like the appeal of how you've been promoting the events, because it basically is disrupting the narrative that Portland, being such a white city, erases the presence and the existence of black people.
Definitely. And that was something that we were really intentional about. We had every time this a multicultural event popped up, or a diverse event or anything, we would go and see a sea of mostly non-people of color. And so creating these spaces has been very, very intentional to say, this is set aside. This is a time and a place for folks to come. And even just the visual, right? Like when we're out, people are like looking at us like, that's different, you know? And then the visual within the black community, if you go to an event and you see 40 other people that look like you and you haven't seen that in a long time, or maybe ever in Portland, that's very transformational. So we had people that were anyone from like, I've been here for 6 months to I've been here in Portland my whole life. When we were at Pink Rose, the owner said, I have never seen this many black people in this restaurant ever. So we were really proud of that.
I think it's also important that people feel like, it's almost like, do you feel like you're taking back some public spaces in that way?
Definitely, definitely. And we see a lot of other efforts of other groups doing this in different areas. So there are some efforts to take back neighborhoods to affect economic change. And we're just doing it in a social community setting. You know, relationships is one way that we can start to do that, where we say, well, you know, black people do go hiking in the mountains, and black people do go bowling, and black people do these things, that we're not restricted to the areas that we've been relegated to anymore. So let's use those. Let's take those back.
I'm sitting here talking to you as another woman of color, being a Filipina American. And I think some of the times this kind of language, the way that you can talk about these things, feels very familiar to me. Feels like, oh, I know exactly the language that you're speaking. I know that the emotional context behind that means something. Instead of saying like, this is how we're going to explain this to white people right now, mm-hmm. I'm going to try to bring people in who don't understand the emotional impact of this. Can you just like unpack what it means to have closed space in a way that's not excluding, but that is amplifying perhaps?
Sure, sure. That's a great question. So how I explain it is that, one, it's a community defined by us rather than by the lack of us. So we are creating the community from the inside out rather than outside in. Two, exactly what you said, that baggage, that draining feeling that some folks feel on a day-to-day basis, where their place of work, where they, you know, where they hang out, where they go get their hair done, are not spaces that they feel comfortable in. And so this is a place for you to come and have that familiarity. This is a place for you to come and express your full range of emotions and your experiences without the threat of being erased or not validated or denied. And so I think in those instances, those are spaces where folks have a chance to unpack some of the things that they've been carrying around and then have a shared and common understanding and then be able to figure out how to move on. Maybe not immediately. Everything is not solution focused, like, okay, great, glad that you experienced that. Now what can we do? Sometimes it's just unpacking everything in a space that you feel comfortable in, and that's it. You just need a hug or just someone to say, hey, you know, that really sucks. I've been through that same thing too. And it's someone who looks like you. We know that there are dedicated online and offline spaces to these discussions already. And this is just a physical in-person form of that. We see that it already exists, and we want to be another place where people can say, I feel comfortable. I feel familiar. I want to be around folks that look like me.
Would you have any tips for people if you have any listeners that are outside of Portland or in Portland that kind of want to do something similar where you're bringing together Black kinship? Is what I really love about this.
Yeah, so this can be done anywhere. I mean, really, and I feel like Portland's a great example. Portland's always built as the whitest major city in America. If we can have the lab here, we can have the lab anywhere. Anybody who wants to create a space can do that anywhere. So my advice is just to be very clear about your boundaries. And so we have folks that want to join. We have white people that say, you know, I'm really interested. I want to be part of this discussion. And we say, this right here is not the time. There are spaces for you. And there are times that we need to work together and we need to work through things together. The lab is not one of those at this time. And so being very clear about your boundaries, figure out what is the purpose of the group, right? I want to facilitate honest and transformative dialogue. I don't want it to be just a complaining session or a bashing session or anything. We want to have a productive dialogue that moves things forward. We want to see some progress. We also want to make sure that folks are really taken care of. So there are a spectrum, the Black experience is not, there's not one Black experience. You have people that grew up in different areas of the country, people that have different personality traits, people that have different purposes when they come to these events. And you have to think about intentionally catering to them so that they feel welcome even within that space. So for example, we had our first event, we had some very introverted people who were like, I need lots of structure. Okay, we took that feedback to heart. We have some people that have families, that have kids. Okay, so we need to incorporate that. So understanding what the purpose of your space and your organization is, and also incorporating the needs of the folks that you want to serve is going to be really, really important to starting a group like this.
Thank you so much, Stephanie.
You've been listening to Bread and Roses on KBOO Portland. Thank you so much for listening. Many thanks to our engineer and our evening public affairs director, Lisa Loving. The Bread and Roses Collective is made up of executive producer, moi, Pamela Santos, Mason Mimi, Celeste Gurevich, Cheryl Green. Next week, we'll be featuring Christina Wong from the Wong Street Journal, which is being presented by Boom Arts. We've been featuring music by Ray Zaragoza, In the River, a protest song for Standing Rock, Chris Dirksen from the album Orchestral Powwow, New Women's Song. We've also been listening throughout this entire program to music by Solange's latest album, A Seat at the Table, with selections from Weary, Cranes in the Sky. And as a special treat, there are some Luke Cage fans out there. We have a lot of music coming at you from the original soundtrack by producer Adrian Young. It's going to be an amazing show if you're able to watch all 13 episodes of it, featuring amazing depictions of Black women. There's actually more than three at the same time on the screen. It's fantastic. We're going to be going out on Nina Simone's Plain Gold Ring. Have a good night, everyone.
Where everyone goes. sea. He belonged to someone, but not me. On his head was a plain gold band. Plain gold ring had a story to tell. It was one a calling on me.